The Kula Agricultural Park is made up of 445 acres of land split into 31 farm lots of varying sizes, supporting 26 farmers. The county's now considering expanding that park, leasing and eventually buying 869 acres of former sugarcane land from Alexander and Baldwin. Joining us to talk about those plans is Warren Watanabe, the executive director of the Maui County Farm Bureau. Warren, aloha. Thanks for joining us today. What's the basic thought behind the expansion plans?
Well, the basic thought for the expansion plan, I think, is to increase diversified ag on Maui. We do presently have a current ag park, but we're looking to expand and increase production of all types of agriculture.
And in terms of this approach, that addresses part of one of the big challenges, the cost of farmland. But another big issue for farmers all across the islands, but especially on Maui, is access to water. How would that work at an expanded ag park?
Well, my understanding is it'll use the same system out of the utilizing East Maui irrigation, their system. So that system currently services our current ag park, and that system will also service this new ag park. So we hope the public understands that, you know, this is water that's really critical for agriculture. And so, you know, we hope the community will get behind this project.
So as part of this shift also, the geography is a little different. The elevation of the new parcels would be lower, further down from upcountry. So that makes a difference with the temperatures for one thing and with the wind for another. How would that affect potential crops and that diversification that you're talking about?
Well, I think, you know, again, you know, like you mentioned, it is a different elevation, and it does make a difference, especially with vegetable crops. So you mentioned water. It may require more irrigation water per acre, but also it gives an opportunity to diversify our commodities. You know, traditionally Maui has had crops like head cabbage, Chinese cabbage, lettuces. I think it's an opportunity to maybe explore other crops such as melons that may need lower temperatures. And so I think it adds to the diversification of our crops that we will be growing here on Maui.
And when it comes to the financing of all of this, I understand the legislature has set aside $5 million. The county is putting up another million. But this comes back ultimately to talking with Alexander and Baldwin. How are those discussions going, and what do you see ahead for that?
Well, I think it'll proceed fine. I know A&B wants and will keep the land in productive agriculture, and this is part of their overall strategy of utilizing their acreage that was formerly sugarcane. So I think, you know, they'll do their best and strongly support this effort.
And because the land was used for so long for sugarcane, that has an impact in terms of the soil. Now, some of the potential talk that I've seen involves potentially organic crops. Are there challenges with preparing the land for that, and how might that work if it winds up as a mix of organic and conventional crops as far as the land goes?
Well, as far as the soils, it may be a require, if you're going to go organic, to, again, you need a three-year process before you can get certified. But overall, I think the land is fine as it is. I don't think it'll be a huge issue. But again, because the mayor has proposed having mixed uses, you know, of types of agriculture, whether it's organic, conventional, or conventional, it's going to take the tenants to be able have the ability to work with each other. I mean, if this does happen, again, you know, everybody has to be cooperative and coexist as a total unit. And I think, you know, it'll be better for the community if everybody gets along, so to speak. And I think that's the main issue. I don't think the land, the quality of land, is in question.
Well, let me ask you about another concern. Farmland, of course, one expense that, and if you take that out of the picture, that's one challenge dealt with. But housing for farmers, for farm workers, another concern, just in terms of the expense of that. How might that be addressed?
Well, I think for farm workers, I mean, it is an issue across the state. We are very concerned about it because without, as you know, without labor, Hawaii agriculture, especially on a diversified side, it'll be very difficult to make it a viable industry. We're here on Maui, we're looking, and I think on a statewide, we're looking for different alternatives because I'll be honest, I'm not frankly in support of building houses in an ag park. I know the state also doesn't allow it in their ag parks. So it could set a precedence, and we need to be careful of unforeseen complications from allowing that. So we are looking at possibly trying to get dormitory style housing for farm employees.
Tents, tiny houses being talked about elsewhere in different situations, or are those among options that you might look at?
It's an option, I think, open to farmers, but I think, you know, we need to be aware because I work closely with the U.S. Department of Labor, and there are concerns whether tiny homes will meet federal labor standards regarding agricultural workers. So we need to really look into it and identify how it can be used and to make sure that the farmers are compliant.
So at this point, from where you sit today, what's your biggest challenge in terms of moving this project ahead?
I think it's basically getting, first of all, finding farmers, people that want to farm commercially. Because I think, you know, one of the problems we have is that, you know, we heard about the governor's call to increase local food production by 2020. And hopefully this project can help in assisting with that goal. But I think on the immediate thing is to get the land ready for occupation by the tenants and getting all agreements in place, making sure it's all properly executed between the state and the county. And, you know, and again, making sure that the water is available, because if the water isn't available in the quantity that's needed, we all know agriculture cannot survive without water.
All comes back to water. Warren, right, thanks exactly. So much for joining us today. Warren K. Watanabe was a third-generation farmer in Kula, now executive director for the Maui County Farm Bureau, longtime advocate for agriculture in the county, serving on various boards and commissions. And Warren, mahalo for joining us today.
The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up in the show, we're taking a tour of beautiful Waipahu Town. But first, your quiz.
Today we're taking a look at a dynamic immigrant who traveled to Hawaii all the way from Ireland. Maurice J. Sullivan arrived in America in 1927, began packing potatoes at the AMPT Company in Pennsylvania. With the onset of World War II, he was sent to Hawaii, where he worked as a buyer for the commissary. It was there that he met the owner of Lanikai's store in Kailua. She befriended him and introduced Sullivan to local farmers, all while trying to get him to work at her shop. But Sullivan had bigger ambitions. He persuaded her to partner with him and open a new kind of one-stop food and merchandise outlet in Hawaii. So on May 6th, 1948, Sullivan and his partner introduced Foodland at the newly constructed Market City Shopping Center. So our question to you today, what was the name of the Lanikai store owner in Kailua who inspired and partnered with Sullivan all those years ago? 941-3689, if you know the answer. From the Neighbor Islands, 877-941-3689. If you get it right, the first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Chuck DeLeonardis Presents, announcing Phil Lesh from the Grateful Dead and Friends in concert, December 28th and 29th at the Mac and New Year's Eve at Hawaii Theater. Tickets on sale now.
The flavorful town of Waipahu in central Oahu has been an outpost of plantation history, and it's in the midst of incredible change with the rail situation in the area and transit-oriented development poised to swing in. Today, we've got Kula Abiva, who moved to Waipahu as a child and got into its history over the years. Now he's media director for the Waipahu Community Association. Kula, welcome.
Aloha nui.
When I say Waipahu, I still hear in the back of my mind, right?
Well, you know, if you listen closely, it's still there.
Oh, really? Uh-huh.
Yes.
That's, of course, that's the old commercial from Arakawa's,
yes.
Part of the center of town, huh?
Yes, Waipahu? Yes.
Could you take us on a tour?
Sure. First of all, I'd like to let people know that Waipahu was originally just a tiny spring. And in 1897, 100 years ago, a group of businessmen came about and named the area Waipahu. Waipahu was actually made up of three ahupua'a, mainly Waipio, and Waikele, and Ho'ai'ai, which is Royal Kunia Village Park, Robinson Heights area.
Oh.
So those three ahupua'a made up what is today Waipahu.
So that's what we call Waipahu now,
today.
Okay.
There's 72,000 people that live in the area.
Does it go all the way down to the ocean?
It does.
Okay.
It actually does go all the way down to the ocean. And people don't realize how close we are to the ocean.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
The richness of the area, if I could go there, the ali'i of the old Ewa side of the island congregated in that area because of two things: mild weather, well, it was hot actually, but mild weather, and nine very bubbly artesian wells.
Oh.
And so Waipahu was basically underwater. It the convergence of the geology of the Ko'ola Mountains and the Waianae Range created a delta area and deposited nutrients, which created a rich area for the planting of kalo. Now, kalo was the wealth of the ali'i. And so with all the artesian wells on the upper slopes coming down and filling that area, it created an ecosystem that made that place wealthy in terms of agriculture.
Oh,
then from there,
okay,
that water went down and they created very large fish ponds.
Uh-huh.
Now, the loko'i'a was also considered the wealth of the ali'i, and they owned that.
That's all along the shoreline.
On the shoreline. Bishop Estate owns a lot of land
there.
Interesting. Many of the Jarrett families, the you know, the Keohokalole family, the Queen Liliuokalani's family, historically owned lands in that area. Oddly enough, three of my friends, they owned lands right on the water. Huh. One was the Kekumano family, who were the keepers of the sharks. There's a great deal of stories of the sharks of Pu'uloa and Ka'ahupahau, which is in the song Pupu'aoeva.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Great song.
Great song. Okay.
I don't even know what the shoreline looks like.
Well,
there.
Nobody does because it's part of the Pearl Harbor. Uh-huh. You can't get in there.
But you were also saying that upland Waipahu was very wet.
Well, I wouldn't say an upland. It was like a sloping down. You know, there are areas that had that were higher than the basic flatland area, and that is where the ali'i lived. Interestingly enough, and I'd like to say this, King Kalani Opu'u, mm-hmm. whose feather cape and cloak came back and from New Zealand, was actually conceived at the spring of Waipahu and was probably born there.
Really?
Now, the reason why, as I said, that they would be the ali'i would gather there was because of that fresh water. The rest was desert.
Oh.
Yeah. And if you lived in the – if you live – Kaneohe is beautiful. Please don't get me wrong. But it's rainy. And it was – you know, they would rather have been in an area that was dry.
With lots of fresh water.
So Waipahu means gushing water.
And is that what made it such a great, you know, sugar cane area as well?
Well, you know, James Campbell was so akamai. He went out there and he used the technology available at that time. And he brought someone in from California to drill with a diamond bit, and he went out towards Honouliuli, they drilled there, and he reached fresh water, artesian water, and he was able to go out and I think it was 30,000 acres that mm-hmm. he had purchased for a really little sum.
So that was the birth of the incredible plantation history.
Right. Yes.
You know, there's so much going on there even right now. I mean, we've got to take a tour on a much deeper level, Kula,
at some
point. But you know what? Let's fast forward to the present for a moment because rail is happening in your town. Where is it at right now?
Well, you know, it's almost completed. We're in the process right now of the developing the embarkation areas and you know it's not as crazy as it used to be.
Right.
What has happened though is that there's been quite a number of small mom and pop stores that have been affected by that, and we do create tours to let our people know, hey, support this organization. They've been there for a long time. You know, that's part of the flavor of Hawaii.
And the community support that you folks do at the association. We want to go on a tour like that and support some of the mom and pops out there.
Yeah, and I'd like to tell you one thing, that our Waipahu Community Association was created to help educate people about business opportunities and then to go in there and then to create businesses on their own, micro enterprises. And so we created what we call the Waipahu Festival Marketplace. We got HUD federal funds, state funds. We have an air-conditioned farmers market that has been so successful in the past 10 years.
I hear it's wild cool.
Well, it's like I kind of said, yes, it is. You can't get on the street. But the thing is that as a marketer, I thought to myself, what we need to say is that this is a Chinatown-style marketplace. Did you know, Noi, that Waipahu had the largest amount of Chinese immigrants in Hawaii outside of Chinatown?
Oh my gosh!
So rice,
there's so much
rice was a big thing. We exported rice at one at one time in the 18. Do you know that? 1880s?
We're going to continue this, Kula,
okay.
But we've got to leave it there.
I'm
right
sorry.
Now.
Yeah.
He is the media director for Waipahu Community Association. No, sorry at all. We're going to continue this. Thanks for coming, Kula.
Aloha.
Aloha.
The University of Hawaii's student newspaper has a long history, a proud tradition, and some challenges when it comes to finances. Civil Beat's Courtney Teague is today's reality check. So, Courtney, tell us some more about the paper and its challenges these days.
Sure, Bill, and I'm especially glad to be here because I certainly wouldn't be talking to you if it weren't for my experience at Kaleo. So Kaleo was founded in 1922, and it's actually been working within basically the same budget since the 1980s. Kaleo is funded by a combination of advertising and mandatory student fees. And the last time those were increased was in the 80s. And since then, there's been a lot of inflation, costs have gone up. Enrollment has decreased, so that's taken a hit too. And ad revenue has dropped from $300,000 to $100,000 because people have been kind of pulling out and don't see a return on their investment.
Well, the whole idea also of sort of newspapers and even at student newspapers, and really appreciate that shout out for student journalism as well. You know, but that's changed so much since the 80s. And I know Kaleo has been trying to do some things with it, putting some investment into this mobile app, for instance. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it has put a lot of resources into its mobile app and into its website, too. So they have a lot of really cool features on there, stuff I would have loved when I was a student. For example, bus times, you can even register for classes, in addition to, of course, accessing Kaleo content and other student media programs. So they have poured a lot of resources into that, and unfortunately, some of the things that have kind of fallen by the wayside are staff and content, but now they're looking to circle back and beef that up.
And so when it comes to also, I mean, I realize it's a student organization and all of that, but I'm just thinking, for example, KTUH, civilians listen mm-hmm. to that in terms of this, the web and the mobile app. If you live in Manoa, there's a lot of great information that's applicable there. Are they thinking of reaching out in terms of their funding base a little bit, thinking a bit more broadly maybe?
Well, we don't know that, but we do know that they're hoping this increase in student fees will be able to fund a little more initiatives for them. For example, they're trying to expand their video desk, their web desk. There's aging equipment, and, you know, students want to work with the best because Kaleo is really real-world training.
And we appreciate that as well. Well, Courtney, thanks for the reality check. Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Courtney Teague, who's an intern at civilbeat.org and an alum of Kaleo.
Thanks for having me.
It's Friday, and that means we check in with Bill Dorman, HPR's news director, about what's coming up next week. Bill, I think this is pretty much the news meeting we just had on the air.
It is a little sort of pulling back the curtain a little bit on Friday mornings. We all literally just sit around the newsroom and talk about some highlights of the past week and what some of the things that we're looking at this for this coming week ahead, and certainly. You know, it's back to school, and back to school means so many different things for so many different folks on different levels. I was at an art opening last night, Noah.
Were you?
Yes, down at Saks, which has some here in Honolulu International Marketplace. Noe Tanigawa has an art exhibit that has just opened, and the back to school week was that.
I know,
a topic
it's
of big
on
discussion
people's
there.
Minds. If you're a parent, it affects you. So many teachers. crossing across, you know, all the islands. It's exciting.
So Ku'uwehi Hiraishi, our reporter here, is looking at one angle of this, which is back-to-school supplies. There's a young woman who's putting together an effort to gather school supplies for those who could use some help, you know, and that this is a lot of expense can go into that. But get this, so far she has gotten 2,000 pounds. That is a ton, literally a ton of school supplies. It's a great story, and
okay.
She'll have that for us next
Sounds
week.
Good.
But, you know, also big week for the city council next week. It's been some time now since the Marco Polo fire. Talk of the fire sprinkler bill, and Mayor Caldwell is out pretty soon after the fire. That comes up to the council this coming week. It's a first reading, so it's the first time through. So we will hear in terms of from everyone from firefighters to condominium associations to the question of costs.
Affects so many people.
It really does. And it's one of those things that, again, in terms of bellwether and direction and shaping a discussion. So it's not just a lot of these things, as you so well know, it's not just the laws and the guidance that is passed out of these places. It's the discussion around that.
In other jurisdictions. How have other places handled this?
Yeah. And well, we'll be hearing a lot about that and more at City Council next week. Wayne Yoshioka will do that. And there are lots of things. Rex Tillerson, our Secretary of State, headed to Asia next week.
That's your beat, Bill. Good luck.
Yes, exactly. Yes. And I think I'm going to track this down.
Okay.
It's going to the Philippines, going to Thailand and Malaysia. And I don't think he's going to get a lot of coverage in the mainstream press. We'll try to take care of some of that here on Hawaii Public Radio.
Let's do it. Bill Dorman is HPR's news director.
Oh, it's Friday. I'm sorry.
Sure is.
It's Friday, yes. Means we read, among other things, it means we read your letters and your emails.
Uh-huh. And, you know, after last week's interview with Christine Altwies, the adoption of Marshallese children was the topic there.
Hmm.
Andrea DaCosta wrote on Twitter, Hawaii parents, especially poor ones, need be concerned that HRS 587 is being abused by the state to steal children from poor Polynesians.
Following Wednesday's interview about the Hawaii Seal of Biliteracy with Dina Yoshimi, we got this. Aloha, I just wanted to say that I agree with your quest today. My husband is Swedish and speaks his mother tongue, English, and understands other neighbor languages. My mother's from Japan, but she's of the generation that feels we need to assimilate and wouldn't teach us Japanese during her childhood. We really wish there were more language choices for kids at an earlier age when they're able to sponge it all up. Would be thrilled if they had more choices in high school, too. Hawaii could be a perfect test ground for a new program that would help give future leaders a distinct advantage in the global economy that we are all a part of. From Lois Anderson in Kapa'a.
Thanks so much for the feedback. And if you've got comments for us or ideas for stories, email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line, 792-8217.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating more than 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR.
Yeah, speaking of languages, if you've ever had to communicate in a language other than your own, boy, you know how valuable interpreters can be. That can be a stressful job, but it's also far more than just translating words. A good interpreter really is a cultural bridge, and it's a craft that benefits from study. Summer intensive interpreter training program underway now at the University of Hawaii. Noah and I got to sit down with the center's director, Lucia Arnada, and James Nolan, an instructor and interpreter at the UN for 29 years. We started off talking about the distinction between translation and interpretation.
Translation is in writing. Interpretation is verbal, oral. And as a translator, your work is very much like that of a researcher or a detective. You may have to go through a dozen dictionaries to find the right word. My favorite anecdote is about Martin Luther's translation of the Bible, where he boasts that he spent an entire week searching for one word. We interpreters don't have a week for one word. We have a split second for one word, okay, right, if we're lucky.
Uh-huh.
So that gives you an idea. We, in simultaneous interpreting, you interpret together with the speaker. The speaker is speaking. You're interpreting what he's saying as he speaks, right? So it's an instant. It's an instant reaction.
And in a situation such as at the United Nations, a lot of times there's emotion. There is so much more than simply language. How do you work with that? And what is the training?
There is emotion in everything everybody says all the time, not just at the United Nations. Mm. On the contrary, people at the United Nations tend to moderate their emotions to some extent. Diplomats don't tend to get carried away with what they say. Many people do get very emotional with what they say. That makes it a little easier, the fact that we seldom have to deal with strong emotional speeches at the UN. But when you do get a strong emotional speech, there are two theories. There are two schools of thought among interpreters. If someone is speaking very, very fast in a very complicated register, saying things that are difficult to grasp, difficult to follow, in a very emotional tone, some interpreters believe that it's okay to simply translate the words, keep up with the speaker as best you can without necessarily putting all that emotion into your voice. Because in a way, it's superfluous. The speaker himself is conveying the emotion. So it's not really necessary for you to be indulging in a lot of play acting. The mm-hmm. speaker himself is doing that for you. What the audience needs from you as an interpreter is just the meaning of the words. So that's one school of thought. The other school of thought is that if you do try to put yourself in the speaker's shoes and reflect his emotion, it's actually easier for you to get it out correctly mm-hmm. because the emotion helps you to convey what the speaker is conveying. I belong to that latter school of thought. So for me, it has always been something of a challenge and something of a pleasure to deal with a very emotional speaker. And I've had to deal with some very emotional ones, like Hugo Chavez, for example, from Venezuela, who were both interesting, fascinating as from a technical point of view in terms of interpreting them correctly, and challenging in terms of the emotions that they were expressing. There's the other extreme of emotion, too. There's having to interpret the speech of someone who is recounting something terrible that happened to him, like the victim of a human rights violation. And I have had to do a few of those when I worked for the human rights bodies in Geneva, testimony by people who had been tortured, for example. That's also very emotional in the sense that the speaker is so deeply aggrieved that he can hardly get it out, what he's trying to say, but you feel the emotion that he's feeling, and that makes it harder. I think that kind of situation is probably the hardest for an interpreter to deal with.
Mm.
Where you have to convey something of that speaker's feeling without him actually expressing it directly, if you know what I mean.
A lot of people maybe are bilingual or trilingual, etc., but what really then makes a good interpreter?
Very few people are truly bilingual. Most people have a dominant language and a less dominant language. And their dominant language is the one in which they express themselves 90% of the time. And as soon as they're under some kind of stress, if you're on the phone and have to explain something in a hurry, you may think that you can do it in French, but if your French breaks down, you lapse immediately back into English. And that's the language you use to express something complicated or difficult or emotional or whatever it is, your dominant language, okay? Uh-huh. So very few people are truly bilingual. If you are to some extent bilingual, it's a very helpful starting point for becoming an interpreter because you don't have to spend years acquiring the B language. We interpreters have an A language, a B language, and a C language, okay? I, for example, at the UN, I'm classified as having an English A, Spanish C, and French C. Because those are the languages from which I interpret. If you have a Spanish or French B, then you also interpret into those two languages, okay? But that means you have to do more work, more of the time.
Is this the kind of thing the students are thinking, Lucia?
Students are very struggling because it's not easy. Their brains are, they get very tired. We were driving over here and James was saying how difficult, how tiring it is for the students after now in the fifth week of the 6 weeks and training. Students, they feel their brains, they've learned a lot, but they feel like they're burning, right? So much not only information that they're learning, but learning how to concentrate, the memory skills, the note taking, and it's the use of the brain at a 100, well, you try to make it at 100% because it's so important. You're the bridge for another person, and so you really have to take your job seriously. This is like conference interpreting. It's a high stake, the subjects that you're talking about and people and countries, politics.
Are there a lot of jobs out there?
Well, actually, right now, it's one of the professions that's growing till 2029, I think. It's supposed to grow like 27%. So in the humanities, it's one of the professions that's growing the most. There's a lot of interest. And in Hawaii, we need it a lot because of the community interpreting. We have a lot of Chakis. We have a lot of Marshallese in the courts that don't know English. And so they don't have anybody to help them with their cases at court. And so they need an interpreter, and there aren't enough interpreters in those Pacific Island languages.
What are the commonalities that no matter what the languages involved are, the commonalities of interpretation?
Well, maybe one of them is the cultural. You have to have a cultural sensibility to both situations. It's not only not knowing that in one language a spring might be a summer, and so that the differences in translation and interpreting might be different, but knowing where your position is as an interpreter and knowing that you can't take center stage. There are differences because in Arabic countries, there are certain things you can do. And there, in the United States, there might be things that you cannot do. In Pacific Islanders, they consider death in a very different way than we do in the United States. And so how to make that come across in a medical interpreting situation can be kind of tricky if you have to learn what their culture, the cultural differences are.
And here in Hawaii, we have such a mix of cultures and not the usual cultures that Americans mix with. We're going to have to wrap it up soon. But James, could you just tell me, what do you see as challenges ahead maybe for this field?
It depends on which way the course of events goes in the world. That, in turn, determines which languages become the leading languages of diplomacy, politics, culture, et cetera, et cetera. At this moment in history, English is slightly giving way to Mandarin in terms of the numbers of speakers and the spread of speakers and the importance of the languages as cultural conveyors. So I think we can expect probably Chinese Mandarin to become increasingly important. The other major development is the introduction of digitalization into the world of interpreting as it's being introduced into everything else in life. There is, unfortunately, a tendency to think that translation and interpretation is something that can be done by computers. The truth is it can't. Human thought is vastly more complicated than anything any computer can do. And human sensibilities are something that a computer cannot even begin to properly imitate, although many attempts are being made to devise gadgets, if I may call them that, which sound like they're convincingly translating
humanoid.
Something or other, humanoid, if you wish. Yeah, I'm afraid that's all science fiction. There isn't really such a thing. as a translating computer or an interpreting computer, although people will sell you even glasses that supposedly pick up on what somebody else is saying and display it for you on the inside of the people will sell you just about anything.
Gee, they could sell me that.
But no, it can't be done, not yet. Maybe sometime in the far distant future, but for the moment, my job is secure.
Oh, fascinating. Thank you so much, James.
Thank you, Lucia.
It's been great having you.
41 students from all over the world are taking part in the Summer Intensive Interpreter Training Program at UH. James Nolan is an instructor there, as well as an author, and was an interpreter at the UN for nearly 30 years. Lucia Aranda is a professor of Spanish at UH and the director of the Center for Interpretation and Translation Studies.
Earlier in the show, we introduced you to Irish immigrant Maurice J. Sullivan. He arrived in Hawaii and began work at the commissary. He's a little ambitious. He then moved and partnered with owner of a quaint Lanikai store there in Kailua to create the Foodland supermarket chain we have today. The store was such a success, even on the first day, that the store managers had to close the door in the middle of the day so they could restock the shelves. It grew to School Street, Aina Haina, Baratania in just a few years. But we wanted to know the woman who introduced him to local farmers, the woman he partnered with to create this food chain. If you knew it was Silu Lau, also known affectionately as Mama Lau, you got it. Sullivan even went on to marry Silu's daughter, Joanna Lau, a Foodland mover in the early days, sparking the Sullivan family dynasty. Boy, that was a fun one. Thanks so much for your participation today. That's the quiz. If you've got one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from Honolulu Waldorf School on Oahu and Haleakala Waldorf School on Maui, serving Hawaii's families from infancy with parent-child programs through high school, now accepting applications at both schools.
The Arts at Mark's Garage has been key in the reclamation and revitalization of Honolulu's Chinatown. A pioneer in the area, a consistent outpost since 2001, it has lived up to its mission to be, and I'm going to quote here, guys, a collaborative gallery, performance, and office space for businesses and nonprofit organizations working to transform downtown Honolulu with the power of the arts. Oh, I love it. Okay, with us today, Donna Blanchard, Managing Director of Kumukahua Theater and Interim Contract Director for the Arts at Mark's Garage, and Rich Richardson is here. He's been Executive Director of the Arts at Mark's for lo these many years. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Welcome. Rich, let's start with what Mark's does today.
Well, I guess a quick tour in the front door would lead you straight to our ticket office, where we sell performance tickets, 120 seats in that space today, 150 shows per year.
I just saw a great pianist there the other night.
Yeah, that's a busy, busy spot, a great place to experiment, to broaden your horizons. And just next to that is the exhibit space. That's about 1,000 square feet. And we do about a dozen shows per year.
Oh, really? Okay.
Behind that, we've got the office space. That's the kind of the three legs holding up the stool at Mark's Garage.
The performance space, the gallery, mm-hmm. and the office space. Okay.
So that's an early incarnation of the co-working concept. Mm-hmm. This one specifically dedicated to creative enterprises, nonprofit or for-profit. Mm-hmm. We're not picky. But it's been a good incubation for a lot of different organizations.
What are some of these organizations that have gone through and partnered with Mark's?
Well, I think Garrick Paikai with On the Spot is a great example of someone that's kind of rose through the ranks and evolved even onto his own tour of the mainland and has graduated out, so to speak, of the Arts at Marks, having started as a part-time partner, I guess.
Yeah. So people rent space at Marks, and they then are kind of drawn into a circle of creatives there.
Well, yeah, they're not technically renting. They're coming in as partners. So there's a partner fee, but then they're family. They are all working together for the betterment of the Arts at Marks Garage.
How many of these partners are there?
13
right now.
Right now
there's 13, and it's a wonderful collaborative workspace. I love the organization. Uh-huh. There's nothing else like it here. It is a place to, so you can sit at your desk and you get your work done, but there's someone sitting at the desk next to you that you say, oh, do you want to work together on this project? And amazing things happen that way.
Oh, I was one of the crazy people at a trunk show there. I did notice there's a new library kind of section. It's fascinating. On Saturdays, you got a bookstore.
Friends of the Library Hawaii has joined us recently. They're kind of a keystone partner in our new renovated floor plan.
It's fabulous doing to have them there.
Nice to add literature.
A bookstore
in
downtown Honolulu. Thank you.
Nice.
In an art gallery.
Yeah.
So you can browse the books and sit down in an art gallery and use free Wi-Fi and just enjoy the air conditioning, enjoy the space and the other people who come
in. You're a great kind of a turning into a tourist hub in a sense too, right? Giving directions, having a bathroom.
Right. We've got a hub status, I think. People are finding us and asking about other businesses in the neighborhood that they want to visit. And we're also very integrated with our neighborhood through street festivals, through the creation of First Friday. 14 years
ago
now.
You guys created that juggernaut. I mean, and it's just grown and everything. It's matured, really. And now it's kind of dissipating once again, would you say?
I would say it's still kind of the cornerstone of our exhibits program.
The opening nights.
In fact, tonight there's going to be an amazing opening celebrating the work of 50 photographers from all over the state.
Oh, my gosh.
So Pacific New Media's juried show. It's an annual contemporary photography show. A really, really nice collection. And beyond that, beyond our doors.
You know what, could we say also that you're going to have this fabulous exhibit opening tonight.
Right.
First Friday has gone through the booze phase and everything, but still you're doing the art there. On First Friday, we can go to Arts at Marks and see what really First Friday started being about.
Right. Mm-hmm. And see your friends there. It's always been the first place that I go on First Fridays. It's a very affordable place to have your first beer of the evening. It's a place where I know I'm going to run into friends. So even if I don't have a buddy coming along with me that night, I'm going to run into someone and we're going to say, let's go over to Grandin and get some dinner and then do this and that. We've been calling it, it's a great place to pregame on First Friday and get to absorb the art and have all that nice community feeling.
As this community cornerstone, what you've learned, tell me what you've learned in the last years about how to make it sustainable and how we're going to go forward.
I'll tell you what, I think that this the same thing that happened with Kumukuhua Theater when I initially started there is I realized that a lot of people didn't know what was going on in that building, so they didn't necessarily feel welcome to come in there and they weren't going to drive across the island to go there. So one of the things at the top of my list is communication, is to be very transparent and very open. Here we are. This is what we are doing, and we need you. You are a part of this. Mark's Garage exists for the community and because of the community, and the community will want to support that as soon as they recognize everything that's going on.
What are the ways the community can support then?
Financially, there's a wonderful new design of the space. If anybody hasn't been in there within the last few months, the space has been reimagined by the architectural firm G70. They've done an amazing job. That space has always been available for outside events. You can come in and have your Christmas party there. The new design of it makes it much more open and exciting for those sorts of events. So come down and be a part of the events. Come to the events that are happening. And we desperately need volunteers right now as well.
Oh, really?
We're always looking for more partners.
Are there spaces, office spaces available for new partners?
There, yes, yes.
And you also run the artist lofts. Are there spaces
And there's spaces
there?
Available there as well.
Really?
I just found out today.
Oh, okay. So we have some spaces available at the lofts as well.
This is an amazing center for things that go on in Chinatown. And both of you, you've been at the center for all these years. Rich, thank you so much. Consider this a bit of a victory lap. Really, we've come far. We really have.
Yeah.
Donna? You've got a reputation as a troubleshooter coming in with organizations, helping them to get rebalanced and go forward. Let's do it.
Yeah, let's do it, Noe. Thank you so much.
Thank you so very much. It's been great to have them today. Rich Richardson, he's been executive director of the arts at Mark's Garage, and Donna Blanchard, managing director of Kumu Kahua Theater, interim contract director at Mark's. Thank you.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Sacred Hearts Academy, and Urgent Care Hawaii.
Boy, the connective tissue of Arts at Mark's Garage, really part of their DNA.
Oh, I tell you, the people that work on stuff like that,
it's great.
Gotta love them.
Next week, President Trump's been talking about a substantial change to U.S. immigration laws. Any change does need to go through Congress, but that's already shifted the national discussion on immigration. We'll get a local perspective from John Egan, former chair of the Hawaii chapter of the American Immigration Lawyers Association.
And I can't wait to talk with Roger Bong of Aloha Got Soul about his passion for Hawaii's music of the 70s and 80s, believe it or not. And we'll take a look at what the films in the upcoming Rainbow Film Festival tell us about gender and intimacy today.
We love to hear from you always. You can call our talk back line. Leave us your comments, 808-792-8217. Email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Facebook at The Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation.
Oh, yeah, or you can just check our page at hawaiipublicradio.org. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Amber Kahn are our stellar production assistants.
Right. Keep us in the air. And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Noe Tanigawa.
And I'm Bill Dorman. Join us Monday and pick up The Conversation. Okay.